My guest is Esther Friedman, a Boston-based acoustic singer-songwriter who started writing songs after moving to Boston, where she was inspired by the buskers who braved street corners and metro stops. Her song, Moon Over the Water, part of a broad-based compilation, received accolades from Billboard magazine, and that encouraged her to record her first CD called Eve's Lament. She completed a second record, a concept album called Cult Confessions, her original soundtrack to a true story about a cultic misadventure, and she works as an expressive art therapist while performing and songwriting as much as humanly possible. So, Esther Friedman, welcome to Song Creating.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Did I get all that right?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Sounds right to me.
So, I am sure there are some listeners and perhaps a podcast host also who thinks, wow, you get kudos from Billboard without even cutting an album yet. Of course that must have been like, wow, what an inspiration.
That was very, I'll say unexpected because the compilation Respond was a fundraiser. Billboard took notice of the compilation and really helped promote it a lot. And I was kind of shocked that they pulled that song out, or somebody did. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy. He was very high up on the Billboard, you know.
Yeah. Was this like one particular song that you had contributed to this, or did you have basically have an album's worth of songs already, or was this kind of the start of it?
At that point, I don't think I had an album's worth of songs. It was, you know, a song that I contributed to that CD for that project. And I was, so that was in the late 90s. I was really fairly new into songwriting and very green at it. But it was one of those songs, you're right too, right? You're also...
Yeah.
Okay, you get one every once in a while that's like a gift. It mm-hmm. showed up in 20 minutes. And actually, the funny thing about that song, I realize that we're not going to listen to that one, is that I keep rewriting it. It is currently in the state of another rewrite. So,
I love hearing that because I do the same. In fact, I was just listening to one of my songs that's going to come out of my next album, and I thought there's a storyline problem here. So I actually moved a bridge in front of the third verse, whatever I did, I can't remember exactly. And now it actually makes sense where it didn't before.
Yeah,
and I played it, and nobody ever actually pointed it out, so I'm not really sure if it was required. But there's always revisions.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, was it Van Gogh or Picasso who said, painting is never finished, it just stops in interesting places. It's kind of like that, you know?
Yeah. Pre-songwriting, I guess you said it was the late 90s that you really started getting into it. What were you doing before that musically? How'd you come into this path?
You know, I think you may have talked about, this is a kind of a parallel that I have with Chris, where We both grew up kind of feeling like a jack of all arts, like juggling.
And we should say that Esther's husband is Chris Levancher, who we had on maybe 6 months ago.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. I have done painting. You know, I was in one play that really wasn't my thing, but I used to dance. And then with music, I really started out on the fiddle. I was a Suzuki kid, if you're familiar with that method. Like this is a method that starts kids out when they're like 3 years old.
Sure, on the violin, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that was my first instrument. But then, you know, over the course of time, I would pick up and put the guitar down. And I have to tell you, I still don't feel that accomplished on the guitar, even though I've been playing it for like decades at this point. It was kind of a thing. Music meandered in and out of my life for a while. But then when I got to the Boston area, I came here for Lesley University's Expressive Arts Therapy program. Mm-hmm. I would walk around and be really jealous of It's kind of funny for me now because I have not a bit of jealousy left for this now. But at the time I was like, God, these street performers are so brave and they're talented. And I wish that I could do that. And
so and in the late 90s, I think that was well past the Tracy Chapman era on the street. But was there anybody in particular that you recall that you saw?
Marty Sexton was out there.
Really?
Yep. I don't know if you frequented Harvard Square, but there used to be a guy named Flathead who would spend hours out there, and he was really talented, and I think ended up moving to LA, but talented and probably a little manic.
Yeah.
Mary Lou Lord used to play out there. Are you familiar with her?
Yes.
Yeah, she was out there. Well, actually, this was the early 90s, honestly, because I moved to Boston in 89. Trying to think of who else was particularly good, but those were the three standouts, I think, you know.
Yeah. Where'd you move from?
Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what was growing up there like? That's marching band country, if I recall.
Well, I actually, from 0 to 14, I was in Wisconsin. So
whereabouts?
Madison or Middleton.
Okay.
My dad taught at the university there, and that was very, we'll say that was very kind of suburban and innocent and...
classic Midwestern upbringing.
Classic.
Yeah.
Except I will say that our family was like one of the two Jewish families in this town, you know?
Uh-huh.
So that was a blip. Because most people were like Protestant or Catholic, right?
You know, I grew up in, I moved to Milwaukee when I was 14.
Yeah.
From New York State. And I just remember it felt so classically, God, I'm not sure how to use this term, American. You know, the quintessential football team, keg parties, you know, it just kind of, and I think they use Wisconsin as the state for all these shows. That 70s show was in Milwaukee, I think, and Wonder Years, I think, was also in the Midwest. And there's just something about that era and that age that, I don't know, it just seems like kind of an idyllic.
Yeah.
At least if maybe more so to people who weren't there, it was idyllic or could have been.
You know, I think it was pretty idyllic because, I mean, we literally lived across the street from a playground. And, you know, in the winter, there was a big field that turned into an ice skating rink. And, you know, all my friends were right in the neighborhood. So you could run out the front door and go next door to see, you know, Jane or whatever. So it did seem, you know, who knows what's going on behind the scenes with the grownups, right? But it was pretty idyllic.
Yeah.
And then when I was 14, we moved to Cleveland Heights, which is on the east side of Cleveland. And it was completely like, what a shock. You know, it was multicultural. I mean, there was like one black family in Wisconsin, and it was pretty much 50-50 in Cleveland and city, you know?
Yeah.
And, I always say I'm really glad we did that because, I mean, it was scary for me at 14. 14 is not a great time to move in any case, right?
Right, yep.
But it just opened my eyes so much to like, oh, look at all these different kinds of people and they all have different beliefs and, you know, different skin colors and I don't know. You know, it was it ended up being a really good thing.
Yeah. I think in general, moves are awfully difficult for families, especially for kids at that age. But boy, you know, it does open your eyes to so much. And, you know, just getting out of where, whatever cocoon that you might happen to be in growing up, you know, in New England here, all these kids, you know, I've got two daughters in and out of college, and they went to college, thankfully, in Pennsylvania. But so many, you know, they go to college, they find a nice little New England college that's a lot similar to their high school. And, you know, it's like there's a big world out there. And I always say to anybody, not that they're really asking me for advice, but boy, when you get out of college, go to New York City, if only for a year, just to experience, you know, what life is like in a big city. And it's so eye opening.
Yeah, for sure. Now, did you live in New York City?
I did. I worked there for 2.5 years after I got out of college. I lived in Hoboken, actually.
But
daughter, my younger daughter lived in, worked in New York and lived in Brooklyn for, I think, 2 or 3 years, and then came home during the pandemic. And now she's in the Boston area here. But yeah, it was, I mean, what a difference in her, you know, just her, the worldliness of her. And, you know, it's great. These kids that study abroad now, which I didn't have the option to do, they come back from that, and they've got so much experience under their belt that they never had before. It's right. Great experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've had some varying experiences that may not necessarily be musical. And I gotta, you know, we touched on this in your introduction. This concept album called Cult Confessions. So I don't know how much you want to delve into this, but it's you know, is there, and I suppose we want to keep the topic of this podcast on music,
right?
And creativity, but then also a lot of that is what comes from our life's experiences.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've interviewed 50 or 60 people now, and everyone's got a different story.
Yeah.
Nobody's had this one yet.
Well, this is, you know, I think, yeah, most people don't talk about these kinds of, in my case, I'll see if I can put this as concisely as possible. I came upon a new friend, quote unquote, at a time in my life. You know, I just was not adulting well, and stumbled into this person who, I mean, pretty much groomed me. And it was a months long process, Steve. Introduced me to her friends, who offered me, like, we get together and talk about ideas. And, you know, I was struggling, and these ideas were supposed to help you. You know, it's kind of the classic, like, just swap it out to Scientology, or, you know, I don't know.
NXIVM was a big popular Netflix series.
Yeah. I know all about it because I'm obsessed with the topic. So the thing about this group, was that it was incredibly insidious and secret. And so stumbled in 06, left in 2011 because Chris, Chris, by the way, never participated in this. And it wasn't the kind of thing where you live in a community, you know. The people who participated had lives and jobs and families, but they were in this group that started to devour more and more of them, right?
And you were married to Chris at this time?
We were, let's see, by 2011, we were married, but we didn't get married till 2009. When I first stumbled into the group, I was single. Okay. It was part of, like, nothing was working. Yeah. I was single, like, my career, money stuff was a mess. I just kept thinking, I'm not sure what I'm doing here. And when I say here, I don't mean in Boston. I mean on the planet.
Yeah.
So when I stumbled out in 2011 and started doing the research and talking to the people and realizing that the whole thing was, and this particular group was extremely secretive, my response was, well, then I'm telling everyone, because I was so angry about it. And so it went from, like, me, you know, kind of having this secret life, which was a weird experience, to, you know, I'm going to talk to all my friends. Oh, and then I'm going to put up a blog. And then I realized, because I had started songwriting, that I had, like, a whole soundtrack to this experience. So I recorded the songs, and to be honest, there's, like, what I call a mini musical that's been in process for many, many years. I hope I finish it someday.
Yeah.
And, you know, now there's, I'm a therapist, so I have a therapy practice for specifically for former cult members, and a book got published in February. So, like, I went from, like, having absolutely no idea why I was on the planet to making this my mission.
Interesting. So I guess it worked. You made it work for you.
In a counter
to the way they had planned.
Yes.
So the concept album, how do you take all that experience and look at it? How do you break it down into categories or into subject matter, one song to, I mean, how do you process all of that? It must be just one big mass of craziness.
Well, you know, that is such a good question because it's such an analytical question. So I will tell you that the process was emotional. And the process of, I don't know, the easiest word is recovery, but I like to call it more of a reclamation of your life after having such a misadventure is really, you have to pull the threads and separate things out to understand what happened. And I'm a naturally creative person. Like it's how I process anything is to, I mean, writing is really my primary mode, mm-hmm. You know, whether it is songwriting or just journaling or writing a blog, of just making sense of the world, my life experiences. So how I did it is, it's hard for me to answer except to tell you I did it because I needed to do it. I needed to get my sanity back. And part of getting my sanity back included using artistic modalities, and one of those modalities was songwriting. And how did I write the songs, you know, in the themes that they're in? I'm not sure.
You know what? And that's probably as good an answer as we need. I think you talked about the songs. Sometimes they write themselves and they just come and it sounds like this. It was just there for the taking, and but you converted into music, and I don't know. I'm fascinated by it. So I'm going to have to listen to your whole soundtrack here. You think a Broadway show is possible here? Off Broadway?
I don't know about where it's going to land, but I see it as a like a public service announcement. And because my approach, Steve, is, you know, like you brought up Nixxiom. In Nixxiom, I watched both of the docuseries on Nixxiom, and you know, it centers around this really horrible, abusive, you know, heinous stuff.
Yeah.
It's not funny. No. My experience, I would say, was so absurd that I can make it funny. So I can take it. I mean, I didn't experience like the worst of the worst.
Okay.
Or dark, as I like to call it. You know, I didn't experience sexual abuse or physical violence, but I did experience being exploited and manipulated because I was not, you know, I didn't have confidence.
Yeah.
And so it had definitely damaging effects that I think come before the worst of the worst.
You're listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM. You come across to me as somebody now who certainly has their confidence and their wits about them. Do you think having gone through this now and coming out the other side has made you a more confident person?
Yes. Hopefully? Yes, because when I came out the other side of it, and I started, I mean, this is too long of a story to get into now, but I started realizing, like, this group of people who I trusted, they've lied to me for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I realized that you know, if I didn't have confidence in myself and I couldn't trust my own perceptions and follow my own instincts and my own internal compass, no one was going to do that for me.
Yeah.
It was a tough lesson. You know, I can't really, I mean, Steve, it's a dilemma because human beings need other human beings.
Yeah.
It's how we're wired. You know? On the other hand, I was trusting completely untrustworthy people. Huh. And, you know, they were going to yank me around as long as they could.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get back to songwriting.
Is that enough for you?
How are we going to do this? I'm not sure. What kind of a segue can we pull?
Well, record. Right.
So back before this, you had a period of time in Boston before all this happened, about 10 or 15 years that you were out, and I know you performed at Passim and are part of that the group that does a lot of activity with Club Passim, and everybody knows Club Passim is, you know, great folk club in the country, one of the greatest in the country. What were you in that, were you here at that time with the Ellis Paul Vance Gilbert's hitting that up?
That was about the time I was going to my first open mics and singing out of tune and stumbling over chords and, you know, trying songs that I will say, you know, were not stellar, but they were first time songs. And that was kind of, you know, back in the early 90s, it was a real scene in the Ellis Pauls, the End Construction crew, which was Jim Infantino and Ellis Paul. And my gosh, Brian Dozier. And John Svecki. And then Dar Williams was at open mics. I'm trying to think of Peter Mulvey was performing in the subway. I forgot to mention him earlier.
It's telling me that I was here at the time, but I wasn't into that scene at the time. And I missed out on so much.
Yeah.
I know.
There's so many open mics. I don't think there are as many now. I mean, it was a real like underground world, you know?
Yeah. So the, what got you into the songwriting? You said you were a writer and a journalist. Did you do a lot of writing without music first, whether it was poetry or just writing in general?
Yeah. I think writing is something that I started doing as a little kid. I was writing short stories. I was keeping a journal, having a diary, you know, I was writing poems. And again, it was kind of the jack of all trades thing. There wasn't one particular style, but I always wanted to write songs. And it's funny, I can't remember exactly how I started. I just know there was something about absorbing the, absorbing the environment of Cambridge in the 90s, all of these buskers in Harvard Square and people writing their own songs that just pushed me over that line. So,
do you remember any particular one particular moment or seeing one particular musician? Anything like that strike by lightning moment?
You know, now that we're talking about it, I remember my first song came to me when I was at the beach. I was like lying at the beach and I wrote a song. I heard it in my head. It was called Entwined and Around. I would never sing it now because it was very overwrought, very long. You know, my relationship is breaking up kind of a song. Yep. I think that's the moment that comes to me when you ask me that.
So why wouldn't you say, I mean, what is it about the song that you wouldn't sing it? You wouldn't ever sing it?
I think I would have to brush it off, but I think I'd be kind of embarrassed by the lyrics now. The music,
revise it, you know, it's only 30 years old. It's true. Time to revise it.
Well, I'm revising Moon Over the Water, which is, almost 30 years old, so I guess I could. I did like the music, so who knows? There may be some some potential there.
The dawn reached through the dark into my room and shook me awake. My feet walked to the park. I stood alone and watched the night fade. Sun rose above the trees, bearing down on a choice I had to make. Two roads met in the leaves, there at the edge of fear and faith. Some bridges should burn, a lesson learned with kerosene and matches. Some bridges should burn on down to smoke and ashes. Alone in an empty field, morning light revealed how I've been deceived. Lies, secrets you conceal.
We're back here with Esther Friedman, and we spent a lot of time talking about your past of being a in a cult, and I must assume that this song called "Some Bridges Should Burn" is on the Cult Confessions album that you wrote. We talked about this briefly earlier about how you take something so emotional and you're not writing one song out of it. You're writing a number of them.
Yeah.
And is this your favorite one, or is this one that kind of, it is a little bit of a, there's, it doesn't pinpoint anything really specific here, I think. You know, it's, it kind of alludes to the grasp of the lying, the deceit, that went on with this. But I think if you were to look at this without the story, without knowing the background, you might actually think, this could be about a bad breakup too, which in any way, I guess maybe it was. But talk about that a little bit, about how you process this whole thing.
Gosh, okay, where to start here?
Yeah, it's a lot of questions there all of a sudden.
Yeah, and I guess I'll focus specifically on this song, because it's a very literal song, actually, but you don't know that as a listener unless you know the story.
Right.
You know, it came at a time when I was really, after 5 years in this crazy group, I was really falling apart. I mean, I can laugh now, Steve, but if I had got to an ER, I think they would have locked me up. They would have been like, you need to be on a psych ward, because I really couldn't process information. I couldn't think straight. And I'm not sure how I was functioning. So the short story is that this was right at a time I knew I was falling apart. I was also like dependent on the group emotionally, which is kind of what happens, you know, like you become, it's like a drug addiction, you know, you're dependent on something that's hurting you. And for whatever reason, Chris confronted me in just the right way at that time. And that led to this early morning walk, which you hear about in the lyrics. Mm-hmm. When I say the dawn reached through the dark and yanked me out of bed, that's because that's how it felt.
This is a walk with Chris, or this?
By myself.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it was before the sun rose. And I had a decision to make, because he confronted me about this group, and I knew it was going to ruin our marriage if I stayed in it. I was actually really having trouble sleeping overall at that point. But something about that morning said, you wake up, you got to make a decision. And I, in the lyrics, you know, are very literal. I walked to the park, I circled a path, and I started having all of these realizations, you know? And that's what led to, and you know, I don't outline every realization in the song, but that's what led to, you've been lying to me. You know, I will say the one specific one is that, you know, every cult calls itself the source, you know, the source of the truth, right? And I was in the park circling this path, watching the sunrise, and I was thinking about how I was going to leave the source and what was going to happen to me. And then all of a sudden I was like, yeah, but that's the sun. That's the source. The source is available to everyone at all times.
Yeah.
And suddenly I started just realizing that I don't want to say it this way because it sounds like I'm blaming myself, but I'd been letting this group yank me around with its indoctrination and its BS story. And as soon as I realized that, all these other kind of epiphanies, one after another.
Your lyric is the two roads met in the leaves. There at the edge of fear and faith.
Yeah.
And was this did the roads meet or did they diverge? I'm thinking you came to a fork in the road here though. But how did you see it in a different way?
I guess I do. So I did see it as, I don't know. There's an intersection there,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That intersection did meet for me in that one of the many realizations I had was, I've been afraid for the last 5 years to make my own decision. Like, I've been turning to the leadership of this group for 5 years. Like, I've lost my ability to be an adult because I'm afraid of, and I don't even know what I'm afraid of.
Yeah.
You know? And so the corner of fear and faith was like, your choice is to keep on turning to this group because you're afraid of making a mistake, or just take a chance on yourself. Mm-hmm. So that is how it played out.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm picturing you on a corner of a brick building. You've got your back 45 degrees to each, and you turn one direction, and you can no longer see the other way.
Yeah.
You know, and it sounds like it's almost like the proverbial devil and angel on your two shoulders, or, you know, I get maybe Chris is on one and the leader is on the other.
That's apt. Yeah.
Wow. What I have seen of cults is that Most of the time, both romantic partners are in the same cult.
Yeah.
I may be wrong. You obviously know much more about this than I do. And Chris is a songwriter as well. Did he write about this? You know, how did this affect everything between the two of you? It must have put a lot of strain. Well, as you said, I don't want you to, you know, have to offer too much.
I'll try to answer it in a brief way, which is, you know, this was not, like I said, like a live-in community. And if, you know, you have these really cloistered cults, it's like, yeah, most of the time partners are married to each other. And in my case, the group, on the one hand, on one side of the mouth was encouraging, you know, outside relationships. But on the other hand, the longer you're in, the more the outside relationships interfere, right? So you can imagine that put a lot of stress on our marriage.
Talk about how you're writing. And were you at this time journaling as well? And did you have that to just a resource for future songs?
Here's a really interesting thing, Steve. At that time, one of the things that finally pushed me out of the group, I lost my writing voice. I couldn't even write in a journal.
Wow.
I had no trust in my inner, you know, thoughts, my feelings, my perceptions of the world. And that's what happens in cults.
Wow.
So, you know, it wasn't available to me, not because I couldn't grab a notebook and a pen, right? That's available to me. But what's not available to me is my own psyche. It's been walled off by a bunch of false beliefs.
Were you sitting down and playing guitar and, you know, like you always did?
Yeah, I did. I was. However, you know, as with classic depression, I felt numb to everything, you know. It wasn't moving me in the way that, right? Like people who do music do it because they're moved to do it.
Sure.
Right. And I think I was kind of grasping at straws at that point, right? I'm like trying to reconnect to something that feels authentic to me. And the longer I was in the group, the less able I was I couldn't write in a journal, you know?
Wow.
I was losing my voice.
So aside from getting out of that, how did you get your voice back?
Well, part of how I got my voice back was through songwriting, you know, the song that you're going to play today. And it was, first of all, in realizing that I'd been duped and accepting that I'd been conned for 5 years, and then rejecting the silence that, because this group was so secret, I immediately felt angry when I started realizing they've been lying to me and I've been holding all this secret information for them only to poison myself I think it was the anger, really, that got my voice back. You know,
but
that
this is a really well developed song, though. I mean, you've got just production value on it. You know, is top notch, and you've got. I mean, it's a full throated song. How long after you got out? And I don't know if there's a particular date or a day that you got out or a period of time, but how long after that that you felt free were you able to actually start writing these?
I would say there was about a month of me reorienting myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, after that month, I started to dig for my own information and started talking to other people. And I started writing almost immediately. It wasn't songs, but it was like, I'm writing down the story of what happened to me. And then I'm going to put it up as a blog on the internet as a way to say to this group, I am not carrying your secrets to my grave.
Uh-huh.
And then I think, if I remember correctly, the song started to follow that.
Yeah.
So, which makes sense for me, because for me, lyrics usually come first.
Mm-hmm. As you're writing this, are you writing this in any kind of a rhythmic pattern, or were you just writing?
I was just writing.
So more to hang on to it and to deal with the actual lyric writing. Later, you're just getting everything down.
And nothing was planned. You know, I wasn't planning on songwriting. It was just, that was the way I recovered. That's the way I separated myself from this experience.
Yeah.
Was to write it. And then it turned into the blog, which is set up, like, you can read the whole dang story on Cult Confessions. I set it up in chapters. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I'm looking. I want to look at the lyrics here again. You're talking about your dad here.
Yeah.
Are you reference your dad? Was he a character in this whole escape plan?
Well, interestingly, I think in a more ephemeral way, because my dad passed away in 2009, and I, you know, mm-hmm. I was in the middle of this misadventure when that happened, which. Made me, I think, a bit even more vulnerable to, you know, the indoctrination. But I will tell you, Steve, so the line is, my dad used to tell me people do things when they're ready. And in the last month of his life, he was very sick and we all knew this was it. And I actually left Boston, you know, my parents are in Cleveland. So I went and I was there for like the entire month of, I don't know, I think June. No, April. April. He died on May 5th. And he kept saying to me that phrase, people do things when they're ready. And I was like, what are you talking about? I mean, it was driving me crazy. What does he mean?
Hmm.
And so it's just a phrase that stayed with me because he said it to me over and over, actually in the last couple of years of his life.
Yeah.
And I was always like trying to figure out what he was talking about. And I think, honestly, that day in the park, I was like, this is what Dad was talking about.
Yeah, you were ready.
I was ready.
Wow. So let's talk about your songwriting in a more general sense, not so specifically this song. You say you're a lyrics first person, and I, it's funny, people, I guess I always seem to ask that question, but you brought it up before. And I think it's kind of fun to hear how people do write, because I'm a music first person, I think. Generally, but how do you, when you've got these words and these lyrics, where do you even start with your music part of it?
You know, Steve, to me, this is so interesting because I'm thinking a little bit back to when I listened to your interview with Susan Levine, and mm-hmm. I think she and I are somewhat cut from the same cloth. Yeah. She's far more prolific than I am, but I will get like snippets, phrases, I think probably in this song, and I don't remember for sure, but the phrase, some bridges should burn, came to me first. And I hold onto those snippets until I'm stumbling along, you know, maybe on the guitar, or I hear a melody and I somehow know that these two things are supposed to be together, and it grows from there. And yeah. I can't tell you why it works yeah. that way. So
and the recording of this song is a bit of a rocker. Yeah. I'm not sure rocker, but you know, it's got a good punch to it. Did that evolve? Did you picture this originally as kind of a, you know, a folk singer, finger picking, you know, song, or did you, were you thinking well, even angrier, like, you know, Metallica, anger, you know, I wouldn't blame you if you were.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I could pull off Metallica. Yeah, I mean, right. I definitely heard it. It's definitely, you know, not a ballad, right? Not a finger picker. But then, you know, you got to bring Doug Portler into the mix because he produced this record. And, okay. you know, the production is his. Yeah. But he captured it perfectly. He captured the feeling perfectly.
And that you had envisioned before when you first had it in your mind? Or does it evolve?
I mean, it evolves. Yeah. I don't think because I don't think that way, which is why I go to Doug.
Yeah.
You know, I knew it was going to be a driving song because it was uh-huh. angry, you know, but I didn't have a vision of like, do I want drums in it? You know, I don't yeah. know.
Yeah. Well, Doug seems to be very good at finding that right place, at reading yeah. people's minds. Yeah, I've got a song I just wrote inspired by something my dad used to always say. I played it for my daughter, and just a rough draft of it. And she said, "Dad, you should play that on a ukulele. It seems like a ukulele song." And she's absolutely right. As yeah. I start playing it, whenever you play something on a ukulele, it's a happy song. And,
right.
Well, 99% of them. And then I put a little reggae beat into it. So now it's a completely different thing. And it's so much more fun than what I expected. So I kind of love, you know, again, going back to your you know, endless revisions of songs, you can just change these things up. But you know, they don't, as you sometimes you forget how something started.
Yeah, you know, often.
Because it's evolved so much. You go, yeah, it's like if you listen to some old you know, iPhone recording, it's completely different than what you originally had in mind. On this Cult Confessions compilation, what kind of diversity do you have among the songs, and what other topics are there, or specific topics?
Well, it does kind of follow the storyline. So, like, there's a song, Starry-Eyed Believer, which basically was about being recruited, you mm-hmm. know. It touches on some of the personal things that are going on. When my dad died, I did write this while I was in the group. I wrote the song, The Stars Took Him Over, and that was about his death. There's a song on there that is more of a folky finger picker called River Road, which Chris actually sings and plays with me on that song. And it's just about feeling lost. Like, it's about existential angst. It's about, like, why am I here? And why am I circling the same path over and over? And I feel like I'm going nowhere.
Now, did you say you wrote this while you were in the group?
I wrote the song about my dad while I was in the group.
But that's not so much about the cult.
No, it's just backdrop.
Okay, got it. Know? Okay.
I guess, you know, River Road is about what made me vulnerable to this yeah. group, feeling like I'm not sure why I'm on the planet. I'm trying to think of what else. The Map is a song about feeling depressed. Again, what made me vulnerable to the group.
I want to ask you now, this has been 12 years since you've been out of the cult, I guess. And mm-hmm. do you find now have you gone off of this cult topic in a songwriting sense?
Yeah.
Are you now the victor?
I mean, absolutely.
You should be. I mean, I can imagine the inspiring songs that you must be able to write from conquering this.
Well, you know, that's funny. I think the first kind of embrace. Well, no, actually, there is a kind of embrace life song on this, on Cult Confessions. But recently, there's a song I just wrote a couple of days ago. Again, just showed up, which is rare, you know. That was like squeeze the most out of your life. It's short, you know. Yeah. But it's been kind of great. I mean, in general, I will say I'm really sadly obsessed with the whole topic of cults, and you know, now it's my profession to help other former members, so I guess that makes sense, right? But it's been really nice to wander off musically. Like, in fact, what I'm finding myself doing is writing songs about regions. Like, I wrote a song about moving to Boston recently and how much this city means to me as a Midwesterner who was like, how did I end up here? You know, I've got a song in process about New Orleans, because Chris and I have made many trips to New Orleans, and New Orleans is so different from Boston.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yeah. So it's just, it's nice to feel like I've gotten beyond the cult in that way. Like, my artistic life does not have to center on this misadventure.
Yeah. Do you find that your songs and maybe the ones previous to this whole topic that you've had been compelled to write about, have they been what have they been about previous to 2006? What were your
I think mostly it was relationships, you know, or Feeling like, what am I doing here? You know, like existential angst.
Because you went through a period of time before the cult that you felt a little lost.
And, I would say, like, adulthood was hard for me. I had no confidence. And it is hard to go through life without any sense of confidence and, you know, sense of direction. So,
do you look back on these songs now? Are you able to play them with some confidence, or do you? Are they kind of thrown away now? They're still good. They're still quality songs.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, what's really funny, Steve, is back in the 90s, I went to the Kerrville Folk Festival a few times, and I never performed there. I've never tried, you know, but I did do some of the song circles or whatever. But Chris and I were there this summer, and this woman came up to me and asked me about, she was like, do you remember that song you played, Cars Drive By? And I was like, that song is 30 years old. I'm brushing it off.
Oh, good. You know, you've made an impression on people like that.
Sure. I mean, you know, I was shocked, and I was also shocked in a good way, right?
Like, of course.
Wow, you remembered that song, and I haven't been here for 30 years. You remembered me because of that song, you know, that kind of thing. So,
you know, sometimes you just need that little tidbit that just keeps you going.
Yeah.
And, you know, it can just be a crumb and a morsel of positivity that can just, boy, it can change everything. What's the next project you have?
So there are two primary ones. One is I'm in a trio now with them. Do you know Janet Feld and Jackie Damski?
No, I don't.
Okay, so Janet's another fellow singer-songwriter. Jackie plays the fiddle, and she plays with everyone. She plays in every frigging group that she can. But anyway, the three of us have started this trio, and it's a total joy.
What do you call yourselves?
We call ourselves the Secret Sauce. So that's, you know, one project. But these songs about regions, I'm going back in the studio with Doug at some point, and we're going to do a whole like album about places.
And are these places you've traveled to, or places you're making up in your mind, or want to go?
Places I've traveled to that mean something to me. You know, I mean, I live in North Reading. I have a couple songs about North Reading.
Well, good. You're keeping up. I don't know how you guys find the time. And Chris is killing. Where was he just performing at Falcon Ridge?
He did the Emerging Artist Showcase at Falcon Ridge.
That's right. Great. Yeah. Well, there must be a lot of music in your household.
Yes, there is. when we're not tired.
Do you guys play together that much, or do you kind of maintain your own separate?
You know what, Steve? It's so funny. Someone asked me that, not at Falcon Ridge, at Kerrville, and I was like, well, sometimes it's good for the marriage and sometimes it's not, you know? It really depends. We try, and it's very funny because Chris is much more, I would say, perfectionistic. He's much more of an audiophile than I am.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it's not fun, it's not worth it. And when we're clicking, it's really fun. But it's not, you know, we're not going to become a duo because it won't work.
Well, at least a musical duo, it won't work. But right. Seems like the romantic duo has worked well.
Yes, it has.
That's great. All right. Well, Esther Friedman, this has been fun and eye-opening and different, and I feel like we've really just touched the surface with you musically, because you've really got quite a bounty of work, and I can't wait to meet you in person again.
Yeah, I can't wait to meet you either, and thank you for having me. I enjoyed talking with you.
It was a lot of fun. All right. Take care.
You too. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
More on Esther.